Welcome to the Brothers Karamazov and Friends, an audiobook disguised as a podcast. Each week, we explore the endless pile of pages that comprise the greatest novel of all time, The Brothers Karamazov. We have three rules on TBKAF, and only three. Rule number one, there are no redos. Rule number two, you will receive no help with pronunciation. And rule number three, you have to do voices for the characters, all of them. We will read each week for exactly 1 hour and pick up the next week where we left off. Tonight we're joined by Emily Lyance, who is perhaps better known to our readers as LM Shady. She is a famous tweeter, so she should fit right in. Good evening, Emily.
Hey!
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're very excited to have you read with us, and we hope that you are also excited.
It's in big red block letters on my calendar, so...
Here we go.
I'm a little excited.
Now, did you handwrite that entry into your calendar, or did you type it? Is this a Google calendar?
I typed it on iCal.
Perfect. But you used bold?
I did, and I clicked it as an all-day event so that it had the pretty red bold line at the top.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not an all-day event, but...
But you never know. That's the thing that people say about Brothers Karamazov, is you never know when it's going to happen in your life.
Well, and it's kind of in my heart all day, every day, so...
Yeah. Is there a way that you can adjust it on your calendar to just...
Continuous event?
Yeah.
Never ending? I'll look into that.
Is that an option on iCal?
Probably. Constant. Apple's really efficient that way.
Now, we mentioned, Emily, that you are a famous tweeter. Perhaps you would like to elaborate on that description of you.
I don't know exactly what that is in reference to. I don't want to brag, but I have, like, a little over 200 followers, so...
And you have also, I believe, showed up on the digital billboard a few times?
Yeah, Oklahoma City has a cool thing where there's a billboard in town, and if they follow you on Twitter, and they like some of your tweets about anything, you can be up on the billboard. And I've been lucky enough to be honored thrice now. Yes, three times. Some people live their whole lives without being put on the Lamar billboard. I've been blessed to be up there three times.
I have eaten three Lamar's donuts. Is that similar?
I know.
Is that a comparable achievement?
As great as being on the billboard is, I would rather have a donut from Lamar's than be up on that billboard any day of the week.
Well, I think we would make the trade of the Brothers Karamazov for 200 followers, or followers, but, you know,
okay.
Different people, different strokes.
I mean, I have hashtagged a lot of your crazy hashtags.
Oh!
So, there's that.
When we speak every week on the Brothers Karamazov about the crazy Twitter following and discussion, we're usually talking about you, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Maybe just you.
Okay.
Last week,
does not make me feel lame.
No. You shouldn't feel lame. Last week we talked to the only person who has listened to every... Or a couple weeks ago we listened to the only person who's listened to every episode. And tonight we're listening to the only person who has tweeted everything.
I don't know that I tweeted everything.
Well, any of the things.
I try.
We appreciate...
Sometimes I just hashtag TBKF.
We appreciate the buzz you're generating.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to join in on Father Zossima's last speech, which has turned out to be a bit of a doozy. When we started this brief recounting of his last words, we assumed it would be brief, as the narrator informed us, but we have since learned that brief to a Russian monk is not the same thing as brief to anybody else. and we are now probably about 30 pages into his speech. But the good news is that tonight I think we're going to finish it.
Hooray!
So, scratchy voices around the world are excited. Emily, you will be starting right in the middle of page 315, and as soon as I have my timer here, you can go ahead and start, which is right...
Wait.
Oh.
Quick.
Yes.
I don't want to waste the time. How do we do the trade-offs during the speech?
Oh, yes. During the speech, if it's a very, very long paragraph, you go, we'll switch every page. But none of these...
I don't think it's like that, though.
No, none of these are so long that we'll have to worry about that. So we'll just go paragraph by paragraph.
Just kidding.
So, all right? All right, go ahead and start whenever you're ready.
Let the record show that I am nervous.
It has been noted.
Okay. Phil, this is the worst. I'm sorry.
This might be our first false start.
Is it too late to back down? Is it too late to have Taylor do another episode?
We'll make some calls. You're doing great.
Not so their betters. These, following science, want to make a just order for themselves by reason alone, but without Christ now, not as before, and they have already proclaimed that there is no crime, there is no sin. And in their own terms, that is correct, for if you have no God, what crime is there to speak of? It's not very Russian, I'm sorry, TBKF listeners. In Europe, the people are rising up against the rich with force, and popular leaders everywhere are leading them to bloodshed and teaching them that their wrath is righteous. But their wrath is accursed, for it is cruel. That the Lord will save Russia, as he has saved her many times before. Salvation will come from the people, from their faith and their humility. Fathers and teachers, watch over the faith of the people, and this is no dream. All my life I have been struck by the true and gracious dignity in our great people. I have seen it. I can testify it to myself. I have seen it and marveled at it. Seen it even in spite of the rank sins and beggarly appearance of our people. They are not servile, and that after 2 centuries of serfdom. They are free in appearance and matter. Yet without any offense. And not vengeful, not envious. You are noble, you are rich, you are intelligent and talented. Very well, God bless you. I honor you, but I know that I too am a man. By honoring you without envy, I show my human dignity before you. Verily, though, they do not say it, for they cannot say it yet, that this is how they act. I have seen it myself. I have experienced it. And would you believe that the poorer and lower our Russian man is, the more one notices this gracious truth in him? For the rich among them, the kulaks and the commune eaters, they are already corrupted in great numbers. And much, oh so much of that came about because of our negligence and oversight. But God will save his people. For Russia is great in her humility. I dream of seeing our future and seem to see it clearly already. For it will come to pass that even the most corrupt of our rich men will finally be ashamed of his riches before the poor man. And the poor man, seeing his humility, will understand and yield to him in joy, and will respond with kindness to his gracious shame. Believe me, it will finally be so. Things are heading that way. Equality is only in men's spiritual dignity, and only among us will that be understood. Where there are brothers, there will be brotherhood. But before brotherhood, they will never share among themselves. Let us preserve the image of Christ so that it may shine forth like a precious diamond to the world. So be it. So be it.
Fathers and teachers, a moving incident happened to me once. In my wanderings, I met one day in the provincial capital of K, with a dash behind it, my former orderly, Afanasy, It was then already 8 years since I had parted with him. He saw me by chance in the marketplace, recognized me, ran over to me, and God, how delighted he was to see me. He rushed up to me.
My dear master, is it you? Can it really be you?
He took me home. He had left the army by then, was married, and had 2 small children. They supported themselves by hawking wares in the marketplace.
What is hawking wares? Is that selling things?
I would imagine.
Or it could be selling hawks.
Or giving things to hawks and having them fly around with them?
Yeah, it could also be like taking products with hawks. Like stealing by use of hawks.
I like that explanation the best.
What do you think, Twitter followers? What does hawking wares mean? Answer online.
This room was poor, but clean, joyful. He sat me down, lit the samovar, sent for his wife as if my appearance was somehow a festive occasion. He brought the children to me.
Well, remember that Afanasy is Zosima's former servant who he once punched in the face.
He had it coming.
Bless them, Father!
Is it for me to bless them? Is it for me to bless them? I replied, I am a simple and humble monk. I shall pray to God for them and for you, Afanasy Pavlovich. I have prayed to God always, every day, since that very day, for I tell you, it all came about because of you.
Oh, wait, shoot. Pretend that was in young Zosima's voice.
Right.
And I explained it to him as far as I could. And what do you think? The man looked at me and still could not imagine that eyes...
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, we have some joiners on the Brothers Karamazov.
Oh, my!
Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Oh, sure. My name's Adam.
Hey!
Adam Fieldson. And...
My name's... Judge.
And Aaron Chambers. Have just entered the room, the studio, if you will, and would like to listen in on our podcast for a little while. So we now have 2 live listeners, and... perhaps millions of online listeners.
Guys, this is just the beginning. Like, 20 years from now, this is going to be a live thing at South by Southwest.
20 years from now, at South by Southwest, people will be reading The Brothers Karamazov out loud. For
live tweeting this,
hours.
Like, crazy.
We can only hope. All right, let's see. Where was I?
And I explained to him as far as I could. What do you think? The man looked at me and still could not imagine that I, his former master and officer, could be there before him as I was, and dressed as I was. He even wept.
Why are you weeping?
I said to him,
better rejoice for me in your soul, my dear, and my unforgettable man, for my path is a bright and joyful one.
He did not say much, but kept sighing and shaking his head over me tenderly.
And where is your wealth?
He asked.
I gave it to the monastery.
I replied, we live in common.
But we live in common.
After tea, I was saying goodbye to them when he suddenly produced 50 kopecks as a donation to the monastery, and then slipped another 50 kopecks hurriedly into my hand.
This is for you, Father. Maybe you'll need it in your travels and wanderings.
I accepted his 50 kopecks, bowed to him and his wife, and left rejoicing, thinking as I went,
here are the 2 of us, he at home and I on the road, both no doubt sighing and smiling joyfully, in the gladness of our hearts shaking our heads when we recall how God granted us this meeting.
I never saw him again after that. I was his master. He was my servant, and now, as we kissed each other lovingly, and in spiritual tenderness, a great human communion took place between us. I have given it much thought, and now I reason thus. Is it so far beyond reach of the mind that this great and open-hearted communion might in due time take place everywhere among our Russian people? I believe that it will take place, and that the time is near.
Can I try a take two on that voice? Like, on my voice from earlier? I feel like I didn't give dying Father Z justice.
No, you did an excellent Father Z, but you are allowed to change the voice a little bit if you'd like. It's your call. I'll warn you that the voice that I did hurts. Man, quite a bit.
No, he didn't sound very dying to me, though. It just sounded like for mine. Whatever.
You know, you just follow your heart. That's one of our mottos here on the Brothers Karamazov Podcast. If you follow your heart, a book will always open before you.
Yes.
And about servants, I will add the following. Formerly, as a young man, I would often get angry with servants. The cook made it too hot, the orderly did not brush my clothes. And then suddenly there shone on me my dear brother's thought, which I had heard from him in my early childhood. My father. Am I worthy, such as I am, that another should serve me, and that, because he is poor and untaught, I should order him about? And I marveled, then, that the simplest, most self-evident thoughts should come so late to our minds. The world cannot do without servants, but see to it that your servant is freer in spirit than if he were not a servant. And why can I not be the servant of my servant?
That's an interesting thought, by the way. The world cannot do without servants.
What?
So it's an interesting thought. The world cannot do without servants. Apparently it is impossible for us to not...
for a society to function.
For this world to not have people who are required to serve other people by their job.
For no pay. For no monetary.
I don't know where I went.
Oh, no.
In such wise that he even sees it, and without any pride on my part, or any disbelief on his, why can my servant not be like my own kin, so that I may finally receive him into my family, and rejoice for it? This may be accomplished even now, but it will serve as the foundation for the magnificent communion of mankind in the future, when a man will not seek servants for himself, and will not wish to turn his fellow men into servants, as now, but, on the contrary, will wish all his strength to become himself the servant of all, in accordance with the gospel. And is it only a dream that in the end man will find his joy in deeds of enlightenment and mercy alone, and not in cruel pleasures as now, in gluttony, fornication, ostentation, boasting, and envious rivalry with one another? I firmly believe not, and that the time is near. People laugh and ask, when will the time come, and does it look as if it will ever come? But I think that with Christ we shall bring about this great deed, and how many ideas there have been on the earth, in human history, that were unthinkable even 10 years earlier, and that would suddenly appear when their mysterious time had come and sweep over all the earth. So it will be with us as well, and our people will shine forth to the world, and all men will say, the stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner, and the scoffers will themselves be asked, if ours is a dream, then when will you raise up your edifice and make it a just order for yourselves by your own reason without Christ? Even if they themselves affirm, on the contrary, that is, they who are moving towards communion, then indeed only the simplest of them believe it, so that one may even be astonished at such simplicity. Verily, there is more dreamy fantasy in that than in us. They hope to make just order for themselves, but, having rejected Christ, they will end by drenching the earth with blood. For blood calls to blood, and he who draws the sword will perish by the sword. And were it not for Christ's covenant, they would annihilate one another down to the last two men on earth. And these last two, in their pride, would not be able to restrain each other either, so that the last would annihilate the next to last, and then himself as well. And so it would come to pass, were it not for Christ's covenant,
that for the sake of the meek and the humble, this thing will be shortened. I began while still in my officer's uniform, after my duel, to speak about servants at social gatherings, and everyone I remember kept marveling at me. What? They said. Shall we sit our servants on the sofa and offer them tea? Why not? I would say. At least once in a while. Then everyone laughed. Their question was frivolous and my answer vague, yet I think there was some truth in it.
What should we do? Give our servants tea?
Stupid.
Each time you pray, you
might not make it through.
Use a diaphragm.
Each time you pray, if you do so sincerely, there will be the flesh of a new feeling in it, and a new thought as well. One you did not know before, which will give you fresh courage. And you will understand that prayer is education. Remember also, every day, and whenever you can, repeat within yourself, Lord, have mercy upon all who come before you today. For every hour and every moment, thousands of people leave their life on this earth, and their souls come before the Lord. And so many of them part with the earth in isolation, unknown to anyone, in sadness and sorrow, that no one will mourn for them, or even know whether they had lived or not. And so perhaps, from the other end of the earth, your prayer for his repose will rise up to the Lord, though you did not know him at all, nor he you. How moving it is for his soul, coming in fear before the Lord, to feel at that moment that someone is praying for him too, that there is still a human being on earth who loves him. And God too will look upon you both with more mercy, for if even you so pity him, how much more will he who is infinitely more merciful and loving than you are, and he will forgive him for your sake.
Brothers, do not be afraid of men's sin. Love man also in his sin, for his likeness of God's love is the height of love on earth. Love all of God's creation, both the whole of it and every grain of sand. Love every leaf, every ray of God's light. Love animals, see? Love plants. Love each thing.
Love all of it. All the things.
Just especially love it all.
If you love each thing, you will perceive the mystery of God in things. Once you have perceived it, you will begin tirelessly to perceive more and more of it every day. And you will come at last to love the whole world with an entire universal love. Love the animals. God gave them the rudiments of thought and an untroubled joy. Do not trouble it. Do not torment them. Do not take their joy from them. Do not go against God's purpose. Man, do not exalt yourself above the animals. They are sinless, and you with your grandeur, fester the earth by your appearance on it, and leave your festering trace behind you. Alas, almost every one of us does. Love children especially, for they too are sinless, like angels, and live to bring us to tenderness and the purification of our hearts, and as a sort of example for us. Woe to him who offends a child. I was taught to love little children by Father Anthem, during our wanderings. This dear and silent man used to spend the little half kopecks given us as alms on gingerbreads and candies, and hand them out to them. He could not pass by children without his soul being shaken. Such is the man.
One may stand perplexed before some fault, especially seeing men sin, asking oneself,
shall I take it by force or by humble love?
Always resolve to take it by humble love. If you so resolve once and for all, you will be able to overcome the whole world. A loving humility is a terrible power. The most powerful of all, nothing compares with it. Keep company with yourself and look to yourself every day and hour, every minute, that your image may be ever gracious. See, here you have passed by a small child, passed by in anger, with a foul word, with a wrathful soul. You perhaps did not notice the child, but he saw you, and your unsightly and impious image has remained in his defenseless heart.
You did not know it, but you may thereby have planted a bad seed in him, and it may grow, and all because you did not restrain yourself before the child, because you did not nurture in yourself a heedful, active love. Brothers, love is a teacher, but one must know how to acquire it, for it is difficult to acquire. It is dearly bought by long work over a long time. For one ought to love not for a chance moment, but for all time. Anyone, even a wicked man, can love by chance. My young brother asked forgiveness of the birds. It seems senseless, yet it is right, for all is like an ocean, all flows and connects. Touch it in one place, and it echoes at the other end of the world.
Is he telling them they should apologize to birds, I believe?
Yeah.
Seems so. That makes sense. It's fair. That's a thing that I may start doing. Tomorrow. Perhaps.
Cars in their airspace, so...
Yeah. It's true. It's true. It's... These are... This is words of truth. You see... Oh.
Let it be madness to ask forgiveness of the birds, but still it would be easier for the birds and for a child, and for any animal near you, if you yourself were more gracious than you are now, if only by a drop. Still it would be easier. All is like an ocean, I say. Tormented by universal love, you too would then start preying on the birds, as if in a sort of ecstasy, and entreat them to forgive you your sin. Cherish this ecstasy, however senseless it may seem to people.
My friends, ask gladness from God. Be glad as children, as birds in the sky. And let man's sin not disturb you in your efforts. Do not fear that it will dampen your endeavor and keep it from being fulfilled. Do not say, sin is strong, impiety is strong, the bad environment is strong, and we are lonely and powerless. The bad environment will dampen us and keep our good endeavor from being fulfilled. Flee from such despondency, my children. There is only one salvation for you. Take yourself up and make yourself responsible for all the sins of men. For indeed it is so, my friend, and the moment you make yourself sincerely responsible for everything and everyone, you will see at once that this is really so. That it is you who are guilty on behalf of all and for all. Whereas, by shifting your own laziness and powerlessness onto others, you will end by sharing in Satan's pride and murmuring against God. I think thus of Satan's pride. It is difficult for us on earth to comprehend it, and therefore how easy it is to fall into error and partake of it, thinking, moreover, that we are doing something great and beautiful. And there is much in the strongest feelings and impulses of our nature that we cannot comprehend while on earth. Do not be tempted by that, either, and do not think it can serve you as a justification for anything, for the Eternal Judge will demand of you that which you could comprehend, not that which you could not. You will be convinced of that, for when you will see all things aright and no longer argue. But on earth we are indeed wandering, as it were, and did we not have the precious image of Christ before us, we would perish and be altogether lost, like the race of men before the flood. Much on earth is concealed from us, but in place of it we have been granted a secret, mysterious sense of our loving bond with the world, living bond with the world. With the higher heavenly world, and the roots of our thoughts and feelings are not here, but in other worlds. That is why philosophers say it is impossible on earth to conceive the essence of things. God took seeds from other worlds and sowed them on this, earth, and raised up his garden, and everything that could sprout, sprouted, but it lives and grows only through its sense of being in touch with other mysterious worlds. If this sense is weakened or destroyed in you, that which has grown up in you dies. Then you become indifferent to life, and even come to hate it. So I think.
H. Can one be the judge of one's fellow creatures? Of faith to the end.
Remember especially that you cannot be the judge of anyone.
Apparently we have answered that question right off the bat.
Took care of it.
Done. On to the next.
For there can be no judge of a criminal on earth until the judge knows that he too is a criminal. Exactly the same as the one who stands before him, and that he is perhaps most guilty of all for the crime of the one standing before him. When he understands this, then he will be able to be a judge.
However mad that may seem, it is true, for if I myself were righteous, perhaps there would be no criminal standing before me now. If you are able to take upon yourself the crime of the criminal who stands before you and whom you are judging in your heart, do so at once, and suffer for him yourself, and let him go without reproach. And even if the law sets you up as a judge, then, too, act in this spirit as far as you can, for he will go away and condemn himself more harshly than you would condemn him. And if, having received your kiss, he goes away unmoved and laughing at you, do not be tempted by that either.
It appears that Zosima's plan is that if you are a judge, like, if that's your job, is to be an actual judge, what you ought to do is kiss people.
And then Aaron's in luck, because he said his name was Judge.
What?
Aaron's in luck, because he said his name
was
Judge.
Yes, luckily Aaron introduced himself as a judge, and then kissed everybody.
Good.
Following suit.
He knows his Dostoevsky.
He knows.
It means that his time has not yet come, but it will come in due course. And if it does not come, no matter. If not he, then another will know, and suffer, and judge, and accuse himself, and the truth will be made full. Believe it. Believe it without doubt, for in this lies all hope and all the faith of the saints.
Work tirelessly. If, as you are going to sleep at night, you remember, I did not do what I ought to have done. Arise at once and do it.
I would never get any sleep.
If you are surrounded by spiteful and callous people who do not want to listen to you, fall down before them and ask their forgiveness, for the guilt is yours, too, that they do not want to listen to you. And if you cannot speak with the embittered, serve them silently and in humility, never losing hope. And if everyone abandons you and drives you out by force, then when you are left alone, fall down on the earth and kiss it and water it with your tears. And the earth will bring forth fruit from your tears, even though no one has seen or heard you in your solitude. Have faith to the end, even if it should happen that all on earth are corrupted, and you alone remain faithful. Make your offering even so, and praise God, you who are the only one left. And if there are two of you who come together thus, there is already a whole world, a world of living love. Embrace each other in tenderness, and give praise to the Lord, for his truth has been made full, if only in the two of you.
If you yourself have sinned, and are sorrowful, even unto death for your sins, or for your sudden sin, rejoice for the other, rejoice for the righteous one. Rejoice that though you have sinned, he still is righteous and has not sinned.
If the wickedness of people arouses indignation and insurmountable grief in you, to the point that you desire to revenge yourself upon the wicked, fear that feelings most of all. Go at once and seek torments for yourself, as if you yourself were guilty of their wickedness. Take these torments upon yourself and suffer them, and your heart will be eased, and you will understand that you too are guilty, for you might have shown to the wicked, even like only sinless one, but you did not. If you had shown, your light would have lighted the way for others, and the one who did wickedness would perhaps not have done so in your light. And even if you do shine, but see that people are not saved, even with your light, remain steadfast, and do not doubt the power of the heavenly light. Believe that if they are not saved now, they will be saved later. And if they are not saved, their sons will be saved. For your light will not die, even when you are dead. The righteous man departs, but his light remains. People are always saved after the death of him who saved them. The generation of men does not welcome its prophets and kills them, but men love their martyrs and venerate those who they have tortured to death. Your work is for the whole. Your deed is for the future. Never seek a reward, for great is your reward on earth without that. Your spiritual joy, which only the righteous obtain. Nor should you fear the noble and powerful, but be wise and ever gracious. Know measure, know the time, learn these things. When you are alone, pray. Love to throw yourself down on the earth and kiss it. Kiss the earth and love it. Tirelessly, insatiably, love all men, love all things. Seek this rapture and ecstasy. Water the earth with the tears of your joy, and love those tears. Do not be ashamed of this ecstasy. Treasure it, for it is a gift from God, a great gift, and it is not given to many, but to those who are chosen.
Aye.
of Hell and Hellfire, a mystical discourse.
Fathers and teachers, I ask myself, what is hell? And I answer thus, the suffering of being no longer able to love. Once an infinite existence measured neither by time nor by space, a certain spiritual being, through his appearance on earth, was granted the ability to say to himself, I am, and I love. Once only, he was given a moment of active, living love, and for that he was given earthly life with its times and seasons. And what then? This fortunate being rejected the invaluable gift, did not value it, did not love it, looked upon it with scorn, and was left unmoved by it. This being, having departed the earth, sees Abraham's bosom, and talks with Abraham, as is shown us in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And he beholds paradise, and could rise up to the Lord, but his torment is precisely to rise up to the Lord without having loved, to touch those who loved him, him who disdained their love. For he sees clearly and says to himself,
Now I have knowledge, and though I thirst to love, there will be no great deed in my love, no sacrifice, for my earthly life is over. And Abraham will not come with a drop of living water, that is, with a renewed gift of the former life, earthly and active, to cool the flame of the thirst for spiritual love that is burning me now, since I scorned it on earth. Life is over, and time will be no more. Though I would gladly give my life for others, it is not possible now, for the life I could have sacrificed for love is gone, and there is now an abyss between that life and this existence.
People speak.
Is that how you heard him in your head as a child?
What?
Like, in that Bible story, is that how you heard him as in
yes,
your head as a child?
As sort of a nasally robot.
Good.
People speak of the material flames of hell. I do not explore this mystery, and I fear it, but I think that if there were material flames, truly people would be glad to have them, for as I fancy, in material torment they might forget, at least for a moment, their far more terrible spiritual torment. And yet it is impossible to take this spiritual torment from them, for this torment is not external, but is within them. And were it possible to take it from them, then I think their unhappiness would be even greater because of it. For though the righteous would forgive them from paradise, seeing their torments and call them to themselves, loving them boundlessly, they would thereby only increase their torments, for they would arouse in them an even stronger flame of thirst for reciprocal, active, and grateful love, which is no longer possible. Nevertheless, in the timidity of my heart, I think that the very awareness of this impossibility would serve in the end to relieve them, for having accepted the love of the righteous, together with the impossibility of requiting it, in this obedience and act of humility they would attain at last to a certain image, as it were, of the active love they scorned on earth, and an action somewhat similar to it. I regret, my brothers and friends, that I cannot express it clearly, but woe to those who have destroyed themselves on earth, woe to the suicides. I think there can be no one unhappier than they. We are told that it is a sin to pray to God for them, and outwardly the church rejects them, as it were, but in the secret of my soul, I think that one may pray for them as well. Christ will not be angered by love. Within myself, all my life, I have prayed for them. I confess it to you, fathers and teachers, and still pray every day.
Oh, there are those who remain proud and fierce even in hell, in spite of their certain knowledge and contemplation of irrefutable truths. There are terrible ones, wholly in communion with Satan and his proud spirit. For them, hell is voluntary and insatiable. They are sufferers by their own will, for they have cursed themselves by cursing God and life. They feed on their wicked pride, as if a hungry man in the desert were to start sucking his own blood from his body. But they are insatiable unto ages of ages, and reject forgiveness and curse God who calls to them. They cannot look upon the living God without hatred, and demand that there be no God of life, that God destroy himself and all his creation, and they will burn eternally in the fire of their wrath, thirsting for their death and non-existence. They will not find death.
We have just finished Father Zosima's massive speech.
Good job, team!
Hooray! Brothers Karamazov and friends. Mostly
Yay.
Friends for finishing this speech. Here ends the manuscript of Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov. I repeat, it is incomplete and fragmentary. How long
That's
was
just
this,
a fragment.
How long was this speech in reality? It took us 3 hours to read through it. The biographical information, for example, embraces only the elder's early youth. From his homilies and opinions, much that had apparently been said at different times and for various reasons is brought together as if into a single whole. What was said by the elder in those last hours, proper of his life, is not all precisely outlined, but only a notion is given of the spirit and nature of that conversation as compared with what Alexei Fyodorovich's manuscript contains from earlier homilies. Oh, so maybe this is... Well, no, I don't know.
They're probably leaving it open for a sequel.
Probably. Zosima's Death Speech 2. Electric Boogaloo. The elder's death indeed came quite unexpectedly. For though all who had gathered around him on that last evening fully realized that his death was near, still it was impossible to imagine that it would come so suddenly. On the contrary, his friends, as I have already observed, seeing him apparently so cheerful and talkative that night, were even convinced that there had been a noticeable improvement in his health, be it only for a short time. Even 5 minutes before the end, as they were told later with surprise, it was impossible to foresee anything. He suddenly seemed to feel a most acute pain in his chest, turned pale, and pressed his hands firmly to his heart. They all rose from their seats and rushed towards him, but he, suffering, was still looking at them with a smile, silently lowered himself from his armchair to the floor and knelt, then bowed down with his face to the ground, stretched out his arms, and, as if in joyful ecstasy, kissing the earth and praying as he himself taught, quietly and joyfully gave up his soul to God. The news of his death spread immediately through the hermitage and reached the monastery. Those closest to the newly departed, and those whose duty it was by rank, began to prepare his body according to the ancient rite, and all the brothers gathered in the church. And still before dawn, as rumor later had it, the news about the newly departed reached town. By morning, almost the whole town was talking about the event, and a multitude of townspeople poured into the monastery. But we shall speak of that in the next book, and here shall only add beforehand that the day was not yet over when something occurred that was so unexpected for everyone, and so strange, disturbing, and bewildering, as it were, from the impression it made within the monastery and in town, that even now, after so many years, a very vivid memory of that day, so disturbing for many, is still preserved in our town. Dot, dot, dot.
Dun, dun, dun!
Cliffhanger. Ready to go. Part 3. Here we go. Book 7, Ooh. Alyosha. Chapter 1. The Odor of Corruption.
Okay. Don't know, like, the seventh word in, but I'll guess.
That's a big one.
The body of the deceased Shemair monk. Shemaihara monk? Father Zosima was prepared for burial according to the established rite. As is known, the bodies of monks and Shema monks are not washed. When any monk departs to the Lord, says the great prayer book, the Yukine, that is, the monk appointed to the task. I'm sorry, Russians, I'm sorry for butchering this so horribly. Shall wipe his body with warm water. First making the sign of the cross with the guba, that is, a Greek sponge, on the forehead of the deceased, on his chest, hands, feet, and knees, and no more than that. Father Higgsy himself performed all of this over the deceased. After wiping him, he clothed him in monastic garb and wrapped him in a cloak. To do this, he slit the cloak somewhat, according to the rule, so as to wrap it crosswise. On his head, he put a cowl with an 8-pointed cross, so the cowl was left open, and the face of the deceased was covered with a black air. In his hands was placed an icon of the Savior. Arrayed thus, towards morning, he was transferred to the coffin, which had been prepared long since. They intended to leave the coffin in the cell, in the large front room, the same room in which the deceased elder received the brothers and lay visitors, for the whole day. As the deceased was a hieromonk of the highest rank, not the Psalter, but the Gospel had to be read over him by hieromonks and hierodeacons, the reading was begun, immediately after the service for the dead, by Father Joseph, Father Paisley, who wished to read himself later in the day and all night, was meanwhile very busy and preoccupied, together with the superior of the hermitage, for something extraordinary, some unheard-of and unseemly excitement and impatient expectation suddenly began to appear more and more among the monastery brothers and the lay visitors who came in crowds from the monastery guest-houses and from town. Both the Father Superior and Father Pacey made every possible effort to calm the vain excitement. Well into daylight, people began arriving from town, some even bringing their sick, children especially, just as if they had been waiting purposely for this moment, apparently in hopes of an immediately healing power, which, according to their faith, should not be slow to appear. Only now did it appear how accustomed people had become to, in our parts, to considering the deceased elder while he was still alive, an unquestionable and great saint. And those who came were far from being all peasants. This great expectation among the faithful, so hastily and nakedly displayed, even impatiently and all but demandingly, seemed to Father Pacey an unquestionable temptation, and though he had long anticipated it, still it in fact went beyond his expectations. Meeting the excited ones among the monks, he even began to reprimand them. "Such and so instant an expectation of something great," he would tell them, "is levity possible only among worldly people. It is not fitting for us." But he was little heeded, and Father Paisley noticed it uneasily, notwithstanding that he himself, were one to recall the whole truth, though he was indignant at these too impatient expectations and saw levity and vanity in them, still secretly within himself, in the depths of his soul, shared almost the same expectations as the excited ones, which fact he could not but admit to himself. Nevertheless, certain encounters were particularly unpleasant for him, awakening great doubts in him by some sort of foreboding. In the crowd pressing into the cell of the deceased, he noticed with this disgust in his soul, for which he at once reproached himself, the presence, for example, of Rakitin, or the distant visitor of the Obdorsk monk, who was still staying at the monastery, both of whom Father Pacey suddenly considered for some reason suspicious, though they were not the only ones who could be pointed to in that sense. Among all the excited ones, the Obdorsk monk stood out as the busiest. He could be seen everywhere, in all places. He asked questions everywhere, listened everywhere, whispered everywhere with a sort of special mysterious look. The expression on his face was most impatient, and as if already annoyed the expected thing should be so long in coming. As for Rakitin, it was discovered later that he had turned up so early at the monastery on a special errand for Madame Koklokov. The moment she awoke and learned about the deceased, the kind but weak-willed woman who could not be admitted to the hermitage herself, was suddenly filled with such impetuous curiosity that she at once dispatched Rakitin to the hermitage in her stead, to observe everything and report to her immediately in writing about every half hour on everything that happens. She considered... What?
So that's a lot of writing that Rakitin has to do for this woman.
True. She considered Rakitin a most devout and religious young man. So skillful was he in manipulating everyone and presenting himself to everyone according to the wishes of each, whenever he saw the least advantage for himself. The day was clear and bright, and there were many pilgrims crowded among the hermitage graves, which were scattered all over the grounds, though mainly clustered near the church. Going about the hermitage, Father Pacey suddenly remembered Alyosha, and that he had not seen him for a long time, perhaps not since the night before. And as soon as he remembered him, he noticed him at once, in the furthest corner of the hermitage, near the wall, sitting on the grave of a monk long since departed, who was famous for his deeds. He sat with his back to the hermitage, facing the wall, as if hiding behind the tombstone. Coming close to him, Father Paisley saw that he had covered his face with both hands and was weeping, silently but bitterly, his whole body shaking with sobs. Father Paisley stood over him for a while.
"Enough, dear son. Enough, my friend," he said at last with deep feeling. "What is it? You should rejoice and not weep. Don't you know that this is the greatest of his days? Where is he now at this moment? Only think of that."
Alyosha glanced up at him, uncovering his face, which was swollen with tears like a little child's, but turned away at once without saying a word, and again hid his face in his hands.
"Ah, perhaps it's just as well," Father Paisley said thoughtfully. "Perhaps he should weep. Christ has sent you these tears." And he added to himself now, "Your tender tears are a relief for your soul and will serve to gladden your dear heart." And he moved away from Alyosha, thinking of him with love. He hastened to go incidentally, because he felt that, looking at him, he might start weeping himself. Meanwhile, time went on, the monastic services and services for the dead continued in due order. Father Paisley again replaced Father Yosef by the coffin and again took over the reading of the gospel from him. But it was not yet 3 o'clock in the afternoon when something occurred that I have already mentioned at the end of the previous book. Something so little expected by any of us and so contrary to the general hope that, I repeat, a detailed and frivolous account of this occurrence has been remembered with great vividness in our town and all the neighborhood even to the present day. Here again I will add, speaking for myself personally, that I find it almost loathsome to recall this frivolous and tempting occurrence, essentially quite insignificant and natural, and I would of course omit all mention of it from my story, if it had not influenced in the strongest and most definite way the soul and heart of the main, though future, hero of my story, Alyosha, causing as it were a crisis and upheaval in his soul, which shook his mind, but also ultimately strengthened it for the whole of his life, and towards a definite purpose.
And so, back to the story. When still before dawn, the body of the elder prepared for burial was placed in the coffin and carried out to the front room, the former reception room. A question arose among those attending the coffin. Should they open the windows in the room? But this question, uttered cursorily and casually by someone, "Why do I all of a sudden turn into a 5-year-old when I'm reading out loud? Like, I have to sound everything out."
Your 5-year-old knows a whole lot of words. You must have been a really smart 5-year-old.
Well, no. But this question, uttered cursorily and casually by someone, went unanswered and almost unnoticed, unless it was noticed, and even then privately, by some of those present, only in the sense that to expect corruption and the odor of corruption from the body of such a deceased was a perfect absurdity, even deserving of pity, if not laughter, with regard to the thoughtlessness and little faith of the one who had uttered the question. For quite the opposite was expected. Then, shortly after noon, something began that was first noticed by those coming in and going out only silently and within themselves, and even with an apparent fear of communicating the thought that was beginning to form in them, but which by 3 o'clock in the afternoon had manifested itself so clearly and undeniably that news of it spread instantly all over the hermitage and among all the pilgrims visiting the hermitage, at once penetrated the monastery as well, and threw all the monks into consternation, and finally, in a very short time, reached town and stirred up everyone there, both believers and unbelievers. The unbelievers rejoiced. As for the believers, some of them rejoiced even more than the unbelievers, for people loved the fall of the righteous man in his disgrace, as the deceased elder himself had pronounced in one of his homilies. The thing was that, little by little, but more and more noticeably, an odor of corruption had begun to issue from the coffin, which by 3 o'clock in the afternoon was all too clearly evident and kept gradually increasing. Not for a long time had there been, nor was it possible to recall in the entire past life of our monastery, such temptation, so coarsely unbridled, and even impossible under any other circumstances, as was displayed immediately after this occurrence even among the monks themselves. Recalling that whole day in detail later on, and even after many years, some of our sensible monks were still amazed and horrified at how this temptation could have reached such proportions. For before then it had also happened that monks of very righteous life, whose righteousness was in all men's eyes, God-fearing elders had died, and even so, from their humble coffins too, there had come an order of corruption, appearing quite naturally as in all dead men, yet this did not produce any temptation, or even the least excitement. Of course there were some among the deceased of old, whose memory was still kept alive in our monastery, and whose remains, according to tradition, had shown no corruption, which fact influenced the brothers movingly and mysteriously, and remained in their memory as a gracious and wondrous thing, and the promise of a still greater future glory from their tombs, if only by God's will, the time for that were to come. Among these was especially preserved the memory of the elder Job, who lived to be 105, a famous ascetic, a great faster and keeper of silence, who had departed long ago, in the second decade of this century, and whose grave was pointed out with special and extreme respect to all pilgrims on their first visit, with the mysterious mention of some great expectations. It was on this same grave that Father Pasi had found Alyosha sitting that morning. Besides this long-since-departed elder, a similar memory was kept alive of the great Shemiro monk, the elder Father Varzophony. Varzanafi. Sorry. Who had departed comparatively recently, the one whom Father Zosima had succeeded as elder, and who, in his lifetime, was considered definitely a holy fool by all the pilgrims who visited the monastery. Tradition maintained that these two both lay in their coffins as if alive and were buried without any corruption in them, and that their faces even brightened, as it were, in the coffin. And some even recalled insistently that one could sense an unmistakable fragrance coming from their bodies. That obviously happened.
What a wonderful story about these two monks. They died, and then they smelled like flowers.
I've heard of that happening.
That's a thing.
Yet even with such impressive memories, it could still be difficult to explain the direct cause of such a frivolous, absurd, and malicious phenomenon as occurred at the coffin of the elder Zosima. For my part, personally, I suppose that in this case, a number of things came together simultaneously, that a number of differences caused combined their influence. One of these, for instance, was the inveterate hostility to the institution of elders as a pernicious innovation that was deeply hidden in the minds of many monks in the monastery. Then, of course, and above all, there was envy of the dead man's holiness, so firmly established while he lived that it was even forbidden, as it were, to question it. For though the late elder had attracted many to himself, not so much by miracles as by love, and had built up around himself, as it were, a whole world of those who had loved him, nevertheless, and still more so, by the same means, he generated many who envied him, and hence became his bitter enemies, both open and secret, and not only among the monastics, but among many laymen. He never harmed anyone, for example, but then, why is he considered so holy? And the gradual repetition of that one question finally generated a whole abyss of the most insatiable spite, which is why I think that many, having noticed the odor of corruption coming from his body, and that so soon, for not even a day had passed since his death, were immensely pleased, just as among those devoted to the elder, who, until they had honored him, there were at once found some who were all but insulted and personally offended by this occurrence. The gradual development of the matter went as follows.
No sooner had the corruption begun to reveal itself than one had only to look at the faces of the monks entering the cell of the deceased to see why they were coming. They would go in, stand for a while, and then leave, hastening to confirm the news to the others waiting in a crowd outside. Some of those waiting would sorrowfully nod their heads, but others did not even wish to conceal their joy, so obviously shining in their spiteful faces. And no one reproached them any longer, no one raised a good voice, which is even a wonder, for those devoted to the deceased elder were still a majority in the monastery. So apparently there's this crowd gathered outside of the elder's cell, and monks are going in, like, sniffing the air, and then coming back out to report to this crowd of people whether or not it smells bad in there.
Yeah.
And then the people are either cheering or being sad.
Isn't this I feel like this is one of the things that Yumi and Aaron read aloud on the car trip.
Ah, yes. Emily is because... referring... Yeah, I think it was. Emily is referring to a car trip that we took one time from Oklahoma to Nebraska. She and Aaron Holmes and I, during which we read like 30 pages of this book out loud in preparation for an audiobook that we would record 4 years later.
But somehow this visit vividly stands out in my mind as you and Aaron imitating the cheers and like moans of disbelief among the people walking into the room.
Yeah,
I remember driving at the time and nearly crying so hard from laughter I couldn't drive.
I imagine this guy like walking out, this priest like walks out, and then he just sort of like silently nods. And then you hear a bunch of people, like you hear a couple people like kind of gasp, but then you also hear a bunch of people go, "Yeah!" Or like some whoop 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 whoops.
It's true. Imagine what Twitter would have said if it existed back then.
No. I knew he smelled.
Hashtag Father Zosima smells. Hypocrite.
Yet apparently the Lord himself, this time, allowed the minority to prevail temporarily. Lay visitors, more particularly the educated sort, soon began coming to the cell to spy in the same way. Few of the simple people went in, though there were many of them crowding at the gates of the hermitage. There is no denying that precisely after 3 o'clock the influx of lay visitors grew considerably, and precisely as the result of the tempting news. Those who would not, perhaps, have come that day at all, and had no thought of coming, now deliberately put in an appearance, some high-ranking people among them. However, there was as yet no outward breach of good order, and Father Picey, with a stern face, continued reading the gospel aloud, firmly and distinctly, as if he did not notice what was happening, though he had long since noticed something unusual. But then he, too, began hearing voices, subdued at first, but gradually growing firm and confident. "Clearly God's judgment is not as man's," Father Picey suddenly heard. The first to utter it was a layman, a town functionary, an elderly man, and as far as anyone knew, quite a pious one. But in uttering this aloud, he merely repeated what the monks had long been repeating in one another's ears. They had long ago uttered this despairing word, and the worst of it was that, with almost every minute, a certain triumph appeared and grew around this word. Soon, however, good order itself began to be violated, and it was as if everyone felt somehow entitled to violate it. Why should this have happened? Some of the monks began to say, at first with regret. He had a small, dry body, just skin and bones. Where can the smell be coming from?
Then it's a deliberate sign from God,
others added hastily. And their opinion was accepted without argument at once, for they indicated further that even though it was only natural for there to be a smell, as with any deceased sinner, still it should have come forth later, after a day at least, not with such obvious haste, but
this one has forestalled nature.
And so there was nothing else in it but God and his deliberate finger, a sign. This argument struck irrefutably. The meek father higher monk Yosef, the librarian, a favorite of the deceased, tried to object to some of the maligners, saying that it is not so everywhere, and that there was no orthodox dogma about the bodies of righteous men are necessarily incorruptible. It was only an opinion, and even in the most orthodox countries, on Mount Athos, for example, they are not so embarrassed by the odor of corruption, and it is not bodily incorruptibility that is regarded as the main sign of the glorification of the saved, but the color of their bones after their bodies have lain in the ground many years and even decayed in it. I like how his answer is no. In a lot of places,
we're normal.
They don't even believe that it has to do with the way the body smells. That doesn't make you a saint. It's whether or not your bones are the right color.
What was the first body that they exhumed, and they were like, oh, his bones are this color, therefore, yeah. How did that happen?
I don't know how that cause effect came about, but, no, you have the wrong superstition.
I hope they still say things like that when bodies are exhumed now.
Mm.
Oh.
Good color. Good color of the bones there.
Good color. He was a holy man.
And if the bones are found to be yellow like wax, that is the first sign that the Lord has glorified the righteous deceased. And if they are found to be not yellow but black, it means that the Lord has not deemed him worthy of his glory. That is how it is on Athos, a great place, where orthodoxy from of old has been preserved inviolate and in shining purity, Father Iosif concluded. But the words of the humble father flew by without leaving any impression, and even evoked a mocking rebuff.
That's all learning and innovation, nothing worth listening to,
the monks decided among themselves.
We stick to the old ways. Who cares what innovations they came up with? Should we copy them all?
Added others. Also, I like how their rebuttal is, we don't want any of that highfalutin new learning. We don't want any of this fancy.
We'll stick with our old superstitions. Thank you very much.
We've had as many holy fathers as they have. They sit there under the Turks and have forgotten everything. Their orthodoxy has long been clouded, and they don't have any bells.
Ugh.
The scoffers put in. Good.
Father Iosif walked away sorrowfully, the more so as he had not expected his opinion very firm, as he had not expressed his opinion very firmly, but as if he himself had little faith. But he foresaw with perplexity that something very unseemly was beginning. Thank you for joining us in the Brothers Karamazov and Friends. Please join us next time for Russia, Russians, and Rush Limbaugh.